Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guests are the editor-in-chief of the New Jersey Globe, David Wildstein, and the director of the University of Virginia's Center in Politics, and the man behind Sabatow's Crystal Ball, Larry Sabatow. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write to politicswarroom@gmail.com for next week's show. Now, we're going to get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. And you can also get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. Tell your friends about us. Remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And please check out the link to our sponsor, ZBiotics, in our episode show note. We really, really thank you for supporting our sponsors because it really helps make this podcast happen. Hey, James, President Trump is taking victory laps for his role in Israeli-Hamas ceasefire in Gaza. I mean, deservedly so. He did what Joe Biden should have done, and he brought heavy pressure on Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu. Those Israeli hostages who are alive were returned, and it was a great day to celebrate. Now, there are some critical caveats. Neither Israel nor Hamas seems really content with this accord. Already we see resistance. And the reality, James, is the only long-term possible solution is a two-state solution, as proposed by both Netanyahu and Hamas. Until they are both gone, the patterns of violence may subside for a while, as they will now, but there's not going to be anything approaching peace. And for those who say this elevates Trump's political clout, I wrote about Jimmy Carter's Camp David 1978 accords, probably even a bigger deal when Egypt was the first Arab state to deal with Israel, and it didn't help much. And finally, I do give them credit, but at the same time, one got the impression that his negotiator, Stephen Witkoff, son-in-law Jared Kushner, and Trump at the same time were figuring out financial deals for all this. So, you know, it was a good day. Let's give him credit, but let's not overinflate it.
Yeah, I remember you wrote something about the Treaty of Versailles and Woodrow Wilson, but
I think
that is true. It's stopping this, bringing these hostages back. I don't know, you know, you can say, well, it may not last that long, but you know what? He did it. And I think he deserves some credit for it.
Right.
They just do and should do it. Now, you look at all the credit that Jimmy Carter got for Camp David, that George H.W. Bush got when the Berlin Wall fell. But they're having a legitimate, you know, kind of moment in the sun, and that's fine. Hopefully this thing will hold. We'll see. But I don't have any problem with saying that they did something which, as of now, other people failed to do.
Yeah, no, that's true. And we called on Biden to get tough with Netanyahu, and he wouldn't do it. I mean, that really was a huge mistake, because it's the only way to get anything done over there. I think the follow-through is going to be more difficult. But again, I'm picking up from Tom Friedman on this, but also the great Martin Indyk, the late Martin Indyk. You know, there's no way that you're going to have anything approaching a semi-peace in that region until you get a Palestinian state. That's just a reality.
Yeah, they're going to have to come up with Clinton and Ehud Barak came up with. It's not going to, and Friedman and other people have said, it's not a secret how you do this.
Right.
It's not a secret. Okay, you have a Palestinian state, you have to have support, you know, from other Arab countries, the United States, to rebuild Gaza, and you have to have some security arrangements, you have to have a buffer zone, you have to pull back from the settlements. I mean, it's not, if they can get to that, great. But I mean, as of right now, hostages are home and the guns are silent. That's an accomplishment.
Yeah, it's a good day. It's a good week. I hope it lasts for a while.
Yes, me too.
James, go ahead.
No, I don't want it. Nothing else.
Let's turn home. Politico broke a stunning story. They got a hold of private Telegram chats from young Republican leaders. These were the Republicans of the future, supposedly. And among other things, these telegram chats said, and I quote, "I love Hitler," end quote. Opponents are going to the gas chamber. They made fun of expecting Jews to be honest. They referred to blacks as watermelon people and monkeys. They said, "I love to watch people burn." And they said their hero, Donald Trump, was busy burning the Epstein files. At least one of these group participants that we know of works in the Trump administration. So how, James, did Republicans react to this?
Well, there's only, to me, out of this thing, there's only one thing that really matters. Look, these bunch of fucking racist kids. Did anybody not know this is who a segment of the young Republicans were? I can tell you, all young Republicans are like this. But everybody knew that this was a kind of draw for a number of them. There's only one thing to look at. J.D. Vance said, "Oh, it's just a lot of pearl clutching. It's just Heinrich and Reinhardt and Klaus and a bunch of the boys having a little fun. Maybe they broke a couple of shop windows. Who gives a damn?" All right, so anytime that any Democrat says something really stupid, all right, then it's all, "Oh my God, and such, you got to clear." Read what J.D. Vance said. That's right, J.D. fucking Vance, the vice president of the United States, thought it was funny and thought people were just overreacting to it. And if the Democrats in a Democratic leaning media of, I don't know, mainstream media, lamestream media, these fucking kids are not the issue. The issue is J.D. Vance. And are we going to let J.D. Vance, because we know when Trump was running, people forget this. I do not. Oh, I don't, David Duke, I don't know much about him. Who is that guy? All right, you knew exactly what they were doing. They needed these votes. They can't win without these votes. J.D. Vance knows he can't get the nomination without these votes. And what you do in politics is the same thing you do in sports. If or in boxing, if they're going to come in close, you make them pay. We do not make them pay. We're sitting here worried about some little 20-year-old snot nose in Kansas who's an insignificant little shit if one ever lived, and we're not focusing on the big target, on the main target, which is J.D. Vance. And we know, everybody calm down. I'm not saying that all Trump supporters are racist, but I will say this, all racists are Trump supporters, okay? There's not a person on this group chat that's ever voted for a Democrat.
Yeah.
But J.D. Vance is fine with it. It's just a little ramp. Just like Trump had no problem at all with David Duke. I hardly know the guy. What about him? Oh, yeah, sure. And if we don't make them, and they get the benefit of us, they get the votes, all right? They get all the votes from all of these people, and we don't make them pay. We just let them come inside on us. We don't knock them back. And I cannot tell you how illustrative this little brouhaha and how instructive it is about how the non-racist part of the United States deals with these things. They're outgunning us. They're making us pay for every little goofy thing that every goofy Democrat says in one place or another. And we just let them, and we talk about, the Kansas Republican the guy's name is, and really don't give a shit. But that's my overall take on this. It's all about J.D. Vance. It's all about David Duke. It's all about us letting them get away with these appeals to these racist voters that we don't make them pay for.
Well, James, I 100% agree. I also would say I am convinced that there are, with some really, really prodigious research, which I don't have the capacity to do, there are a number of neo-Nazis buried in the bowels of this administration because that's part of their constituency. And we know about one already ready.
We're naming military bases against racists and traitors.
Right. And
right in front of you.
One of them we know, Mr. Ingrassia. And the reason I want more on that is because this administration's entire attack, phony attack, against universities and colleges is based on their standing up against anti-Semitism. Bullshit. That's part of their constituency.
Think of how much, all right, this is a really dumb thing. All right, well, got to get that out of the way of what the AG Senate candidate texted to another delegate or something like that. There's no evidence that this guy's a violent person. He was stupid, apologize. Everybody's heard about that. Who's heard about J.D. Vance's deal? And then you hear the commentary. This is what gets to me. Oh, the young blacks didn't show up. Young black males didn't show up because they just don't feel like they have a stake in the election. They don't feel like they have a stake in the country. They're divorced from politics. When you see J.D. Vance, the vice president of the United States of America, the probable Republican nominee for president of the United States of America, saying that this anti-Semitism, this horrible racism, is just a little locker room towel snapping. And why should you give a shit? And you got every commentator, every cable TV jock, every political commentator says they don't have a stake in it anymore. They've been left out. Well, you know what? J.D. Vance and these kids on this chain they have, they're going to include you, and it ain't going to be in a good way, let me tell you. So you do have you have a lot at stake here. James, you're going to get included.
I don't think you're going to let people forget about Mr. Vance.
I am to J.D. Vance of what they said rooted at 9/11, a noun, a verb in J.D. Vance.
You know, I get notices or I get emails. It says, you know, you never criticize Democrats. That's actually not true.
Oh, God. But anyway, what are people talking about?
I am going to express a criticism of a Democrat I admire, and that is Senator Chris Coons of Delaware, a serious lawmaker, a good guy. But it was disappointing when he criticized former special counsel Jack Smith for examining the phone records of some senators in his investigation of Trump's efforts on the January 6th to overturn the previous election. One of those senators, South Carolina's Lindsey Graham, called election officials in Georgia, which Biden had won, to see if they could turn it around. A grand jury even wanted to indict him. Another, Wisconsin's Ron Johnson, tried to send a set of fake electors, Biden carried the Badger State too, to Vice President Pence. Both of those were part of the Smith investigation and mandate. If he hadn't investigated these actions, it would have been a dereliction of duty. Senator Coons, you are a very decent and able lawmaker. But even in these acrimonious times, I fear you still see the Senate as a club. Lindsey Graham and Ron Johnson don't deserve to be treated any differently than any ordinary citizen. Jack Smith was right, and your criticism only gave fodder to the Trump apologist on that score.
Well, first of all, the motor mouth says, "Say you never criticize the Democrats." Maybe they don't listen to the show. This podcast, Politics 2020 War Room, was the most relentlessly Biden shouldn't run for re-election podcast, newscast, anything else that there was in the United States. So I don't know what the fuck these people are talking about other than just running their stupid mouths. But I don't know, man, I didn't get enough sleep last night, so I'm cranky.
I had the same problem. All right, anyway, Chris Coons, my criticism of you pales, however, next to what Mr. Carville has said to J.D. Vance.
I like Chris Coons, a nice guy. He was just trying to be a club member, and he was probably trying to get an extra vote in the committee to get some bullshit bill out. But anyway, you're forgiven. Acknowledge,
Sort of.
Bad move. Forgiven.
Get back in the game after a long night with Z-Biotics. Well, let's just say I came back. I had to fly back from Chicago. It was, of course, a big surprise. It was delays involved. And I probably, you know, while I'm waiting on a plane, I get on a plane, you know, and you drink, and it's 30,000 feet, and the atmosphere is different. And I get to New Orleans. Of course, I have a little trouble going to sleep. I got to get up in the morning to do podcasts. And I have experience with this, by the way. I'm going to be 81 here in less than 2 weeks. But I'm telling you, based on my experience yesterday from having too many pops in the airport and too many pops on the airplane and having to get up and get ready for the podcast this morning, so I can endorse this without fear of hesitation, equivocation, or reservation.
God, J.D. Vance wishes you never would have heard of Z-Biotics.
There you go. Yeah, I'm all fired up. Like, I got J.D. Vance. J.D. Vance. I am obsessed with J.D. Vance now.
You know, we speak for a lot of us when we say that after a night with drinks, we aren't bouncing back the way we used to. It used to be a big decision. Do you want a great night out or a great next day? Luckily, with pre-alcohol, you don't need to compromise. To fill you in, Z-Biotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Now, here's how it works. When you drink alcohol, it gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's the buildup of this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for rough days after drinking. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. Just remember, to make pre-alcohol your first drink of the night, drink responsibly, and you'll feel your best tomorrow. Thanks to Z-Biotics, James even goes on runs or advises candidates after a long, long night and goes after J.D. Vance. Every time you have a Z-Biotics pre-alcohol before drinks, it makes such a difference. Whether you're writing all day, exercising, or speaking to an audience, Z-Biotics is our MVP when it counts. Imagine how great it's going to feel to wake up ready to take on the day ahead. After all, fall's here, and that means it's time to enjoy cooler weather and some drinks out with friends. So whether you're enjoying a pint at a fall festival or a spooky cocktail at a Halloween party, don't forget to drink a pre-alcohol before drinking. You'll be able to celebrate and still wake up feeling great the next day. Go to zbiotics.com/warroom to learn more and get 15% off your first order when you use War Room at checkout. Z-Biotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. No questions asked. Remember to head to zbiotics.com/warroom and use the code War Room at checkout for 15% off. The link also is in our show notes. Hey, James, our guest is David Wildstein, who was a New Jersey Republican operative. He's now the editor-in-chief of the New Jersey Globe, an influential political website and newsletter. David, New Jersey gubernatorial contest, one of two big ones this year. There are conflicting indicators. Generally, the Garden State votes out a party that's controlled the governorship for 8 years, and that's offset by clear indications so far this is a year favoring Democrats. So let's talk about is what important issues, taxes, spending, environment, social issues, separate Democratic Congresswoman Mikey Sherrill and former Republican candidate for governor Jack Cittarelli.
So Mikey Sherrill is running on national issues. She is hoping that Donald Trump being upside down in New Jersey will carry her to a victory. Cittarelli is trying to focus on state issues. And, you know, Jersey's it's one of the five states that has gubernatorial elections in odd years. That was deliberate. New Jersey decided it wanted state elections to be fought on state issues. That's getting harder and harder to do. And look, New Jersey's got 800,000 more Democrats than Republicans. So Sherrill's job right now is to simply motivate that Democratic base to say, we don't want Republicans in New Jersey anywhere near our government, our taxes, our legislation, anything at all.
So, David, Sherrill is running against Trump, really. And Cittarelli is running against the unpopular Democratic governor, Phil Murphy. Who's the bigger albatross?
Well, I have, it's going to age me. This is my 14th governor's race in New Jersey. I have never seen a sitting governor less relevant in a gubernatorial election than Phil Murphy. People are not talking about Phil Murphy, and his approval ratings have remained just about the same for the entirety of his second term. He's not really an issue the way he was in his own reelection when it was during COVID. This is about Trump in terms of how Sherrill's looking at it. And the interesting thing here is Cittarelli was a moderate Republican, never Trumper. He wouldn't support Trump in 16. He wouldn't support him in 2020. Now, he went up to the golf club and had some long conversations with the president and walked away with an endorsement in the primary. Now, Cittarelli is the Trump candidate in New Jersey. And what he's hoping is that he's going to be able to move that base, that Trump base that came within 6 points of carrying blue Jersey last year. He's hoping he's going to be able to motivate them to come out and vote while Democrats in the cities are sitting at home and not really feeling any urgency.
Yeah, one controversy I do know about, I have a number of good Naval Academy sources, and you've written about this, when in a leak, it was revealed that Mikey Sherrill did not walk with her graduating class at Annapolis because she didn't turn in classmates for cheating. She graduated, served for 9 years as a decorated Naval Academy helicopter pilot. The Academy, as you reported, lists her as one of its distinguished alums. Not turning in others for cheating is a clear violation of the honor code, but an offense many of us can understand, maybe even identify with. Not walking with her class was an appropriate remedy, but that small blemish certainly doesn't overshadow a really admirable record serving her country, David.
Yeah, this is one that everybody, including the media, what's left of us, the four or five reporters that are left in New Jersey today. But yeah. It's a hard one to reckon with. Nobody wants to disrespect her service. Certainly not me. She's got a great resume and she built a terrific career in the military. But we keep coming back to, do we know what really happened? And there are uncertainties here. I, for one, I wish if she would just say, here is my college disciplinary record. And boy, I got to tell you, I don't want my disciplinary record when I was that age coming forward. I don't even want my disciplinary record from 10 years ago coming out. But she was in an academy. She's running for governor. If there's nothing there, then just put this to bed and show us. I'll tell you the other thing, Al, that concerns me is there's a certain virtue to saying I didn't want to snitch on my friends. There's almost a redeeming quality about that. But then I think about, well, what happens next year when something's going on in her administration? She's the governor. I ask her, well, what happened? And she doesn't level with me because she doesn't want to snitch on her friends.
David, I got to tell you, I just disagree with most of what you've just said. Okay. Number one, the
most
Naval
people
Academy,
usually do, Al. That's
well,
okay.
No, David, listen to me. The Naval Academy would not list her as one of their more distinguished alums if there was something untoward there. They know that they have that record. She wouldn't be praised by friends I have from the Naval Academy. She did something dumb, and then she served honorably. To my knowledge, Jack Cittarelli never served. He avoided military service. So if this is a debate over service, duty, and honor, Cheryl wins going away.
Yeah, you know, I respectfully, you know, there's some questions here about that because, you know, you think about the context of the time. The Navy cheating scandal was a big deal. It came 3 years after Tailhook. 61 members of her class didn't walk at graduation. There isn't a lot of explanations about that. I'm not disparaging her. I'm just saying, I'd like to know what really happened. I'd like to know what her role was before she becomes governor. And if it's what I hope it is, Al, which is that this was absolutely nothing, that she did absolutely nothing wrong, then I'd feel a lot better. But I do have to point out to you, you know, respectfully, when she ran for Congress the first time in 2018, there were rumblings about this. And I heard about it, and I went to her campaign, and I said, what's the deal with Mikey Sherrill and this scandal? And they said to me, absolutely nothing. She wasn't connected at all to it. She had nothing to do with it. I took her at her word on that. I'd still like to.
David, I'm going to help you take her at her word and say, okay, take the Naval Academy at its word. I have such enormous respect for the Academy.
Me too.
She clearly did something wrong. She didn't turn in classmates. But the idea that there's anything more there, it would mean the Naval Academy is lying. And I simply do not believe that. And I don't know why Jack Cittarelli, who avoided military service, wants to talk about service.
Yeah, and what I think is, you know, look, when you're from New Jersey, and I don't say this with any great pride or anything, but when you're from New Jersey, you grow to become disappointed, disillusioned with those that you elect for office. And, you know,
with
part of
cause.
My job, I don't take sides in these elections. I don't endorse, you know, I don't run a Democratic site or a Republican site, but I just want to ask these questions, maybe with this glimmer of hope, unrealistic as it may be, that as I get older and I get into the sunset of my life after 52 years in Jersey politics, that maybe I'll become a little less disappointed with the people serving in office than I have been.
James, you could tell David about the sunset of our lives. Go ahead, James.
Yeah, so first of all, we vouched for David's bipartisan bona fides. He was tried to get the great Susan McHugh, who at 30 years old was Harry Reid's chief of staff in the United States Senate, who's as big a Democrat as I know, as good a friend as I have. She produced a documentary on me. She raises money. So she says you're okay, you're objective. She said it. I believe it. That settles it. All right. Secondly, I'll put my 2 cents worth in. If you don't believe it, you say, I don't believe the Naval Academy. I think the institution that trains our naval officers is not leveling with us. If you want to make that charge, go ahead. I don't think it'll get very far. But having said all of that, so we have the Democratic primary. It was a talented field. I mean, I forgot all the people in there, but there were like 5 people, and I went through it, and I said, shit, I could vote for any one of these 5. She wins the primary by more than just a little bit. And she was one of the class of 2018, highly regarded, highly thought of. The validity of the campaign is close. How would you just grade her as a candidate? Just being an observer and seeing where she started after the primary, where she is now, how she turned out as a gubernatorial candidate. And remember, we still got a long ways to go here.
You know, you start out when you grade a candidate, as you two know much better than I do, with what kind of person they are. I think she's a terrific person. I think she has dedicated her life to service. She's raising 4 kids. That I don't think, I think that is unimpeachable.
Yeah, great person. Right.
She was a great candidate for Congress. Here, I'd like to see, and by the way, I have the same complaint with Cittarelli sometimes. I'd like to see more specifics on issues. I'd like to know when you ask a question that you get an answer and you don't get a whole lot of, I don't know what she just said. I'm seeing something a little different from her this time than I have in the other 4 times that I've covered her. And so, you know, as a candidate, I think she may be, you know, still trying to find her footing. And look, you know, you guys have been in, you know, around this. She's the favorite. She is, you know, there has never been a poll, not in the primary, not in the in the general, that has shown her in anything other than first place. And you know, if I were her, I probably would say, you know what, if I'm in first place for every poll since 2024, I don't want to do anything to screw it up. So let me
interpret what you just told me.
Yeah.
She's cautious.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Very cautious.
Very cautious. Okay. Yeah. And Cinerelli is not. He's the aggressor in this. Is that fair to say?
He's a Jersey guy. Right. So yes, he's always aggressive and has become pretty good at it. He's become a pretty good campaigner. He's got his sound bites down pat, and he knows state government.
Okay. So what let's get our analyst hat off and let's act like we're a political consultant again, because political consultants always want to be an analyst and analysts want to be political consultants. So let's be frozen. What would you say if you were her campaign consultant, and you, what do you have, 3 weeks left to go, maybe a little bit more into this, and you're right about that, right? What would you say you want to see her do coming down the stretch to put this away?
If I were advising her campaign, I would be concentrating a lot more on the Black vote, on the Hispanic vote, on that base. I would be building an incredible, and invoke the old name of Regina Thomas, but that drop and drag sort of mentality of exciting the base and making sure that you're getting a whole lot of votes out of Newark and Patterson and parts of Jersey City and Trenton and Elizabeth and
Camden.
You know, that's what I would really think that she should be doing right now, is just going back to the base.
So I want to take the editorialize here about 45 seconds.
Uh-huh.
Mikey, you got a shot here. See these asshole Republicans who are all this racist, anti-Semitic stuff, talking about how Hitler and stuff. J.D. Vance is totally fine with that. Ask Cinerelli, does he condemn J.D. Vance? Make it front and center. Put a big name, all right? Put a big name and says, J.D. Vance says that's all pearl clutching. It was this little locker room towel snapping. Does Jack Cinerelli agree with that? Because that they always talk about anti-Semitism at Harvard, and this and that.
Yeah.
What about what these... All right, these were a bunch of snot-nosed assholes. J.D. Vance was fine with that. Make them pay at the highest level. Don't make a 20-year-old from Kansas pay. Make the vice president pay, and make Cinerelli jump in there. Because Cinerelli, to the extent that these kind of people exist in New Jersey, and they do, I know, you know,
yeah.
Right? And Cinerelli wants these votes. I'm not saying that he agrees with any of this, so that's who he is. I'm not at all suggesting that Cinerelli is an anti-Semite or is a racist, but it's not enough just to be that. Clearly, Vance is very comfortable and tolerant of that, as was Trump of David Duke. We never make them pay, and that's why Democrats are weenies.
Yeah, That's sort of where Cinerelli's rocking a hard place is
right.
he can't win without him, yet
right.
Maybe he can't win with him. And maybe that's just maybe we'll see on election day, either he's governor or he found himself in a position where he couldn't, just find the right place. And look, I get in trouble when I say this, but at my age, I don't worry about getting in trouble anymore. It's still a little harder to run against a woman,
It's hard to run as a woman too.
It's very hard.
Presents unique. On the whole, I think I'd still rather be a man. But okay, go ahead.
I'm not going near that.
David,
all I can say is thank God James is a man.
Yeah, but I do think we could have a great show on, you know, advantages and disadvantages of being a female candidate. And I always tell people, it doesn't matter because I'm a Democrat and we're never going to stop nominating women, nor should we. Okay? Yeah, it's a fact of life.
I look back and, again, as I get older, I look at the older days more, you know, with greater reverence. But I think about a guy that we all knew, Frank Lautenberg. And the first time Frank Lautenberg ran for the Senate, he was running against Millicent Fenwick. And she was a great candidate. And I remember
Doomsbury or something. Wasn't she?
I mean, she was, you know, she was the etiquette editor of Vogue. She was distinguished. Everybody loved Millicent Fenwick. And I remember Lautenberg, first time candidate. He's running against her in the general election, and he starts to attack her. He starts to beat her up a little bit, and all his friends are saying, "Frank, what are you doing? You can't attack Millicent Fenwick. You can't attack a woman like this." And Lautenberg said, "Nope, this is how I'm going to win." And he you know, I don't mean this literally, but he grabbed Millicent Fenwick by the pearls, and he banged her head against the pavement. And if he didn't do that, none of us would remember who Frank Lautenberg was.
Before I let you go, David, I want a story. There's an interesting story in politics in New Jersey. I want you to tell our listeners or viewers or whatever the story of Jim McGreevy. Who is Jim McGreevy? What did he do? And what is he doing now? Because I think this is one of the great illuminate. And by the way, I'm going to help him. I called him after I talked to you and said, "I don't know if I can get to Jersey City, but I'm on this video, Jim. You'll just tell us the Jim McGreevy story."
Yeah, I mean, briefly, he was a great street politician. He was one of the most gifted campaigners I'd ever seen. Almost beat Christy Whitman, came back 4 years later, won in a landslide. He's the governor of New Jersey. He's like 40, early 40s, and he wound up resigning because he came out as gay. And in 2004, standing next to his wife and his parents, we all knew Jack McGreevy, a Marine. This was not easy for him to stand there when Jim McGreevy said, "I am a gay American." He resigned the office. And has been on a search for redemption for the last 21 years. He studied theology. He has been involved in a reentry system of helping formerly incarcerated people build a new life. And now he's decided to make a comeback. He's in his early 70s, and he's running for mayor of Jersey City, which is second largest city in New Jersey, booming economically. It's really the fifth borough of the fifth borough of New York. If you were to accept the idea that New York would rather give up Staten Island to New Jersey and take Jersey City and Hoboken, he's in a tough race, but like Jerry Brown did, he's coming back and he's saying, "I want to prove myself again. I want to redeem myself. I can help this city." And I got to tell you, this campaign is something to watch.
I'm just going to say this. As a lifelong Roman Catholic and a Clintonite, I believe in redemption. Mm-hmm. Okay? I think redemption is the greatest thing in the world. And Jim McGreevy, I'll say this to you right now, I hope you win. I admire your courage. Like anybody else in politics, you don't want to leave. You enjoy it. You have something to contribute. You go, boy.
I'd say it's a hell of a story. Let me ask you one final question, David. You've really been a good guest. Let me talk about the New Jersey demographics. If Cinerelli wins, how will his coalition differ from the votes he got in 2021? And the same with Cheryl. How would her coalition differ from Murphy's?
Her coalition looks to be very similar to Murphy's, which is, what you have in New Jersey is a more powerful high informed suburbs than we've had in recent elections. In the Democratic primary, I thought this was a fascinating number. 63% of the Democrats who voted in the primary were women. You know, a 63-37 split is pretty good. That explains why she won the Democratic primary by that much. If she wins, it's because women, young families, they're identifying with her and because they like her. Chitterelli, if he wins, he's going to be in a position of, you know, a lot of Republicans, which is he's going to have a Democratic legislature. There is no chance at all that Republicans are going to take the lower house. The Senate's not up. He's going to have to deal with Democrats if he's going to effectively govern.
James, you have anything to wrap this up?
Make a final point. I'm doing since it's Sheldon Whitehouse and I doing these kind of virtual Zoom town halls on insurance rates, and I want to expand it to electricity rates. I think people are getting crushed by high insurance rates and high electricity rates. Are these issues starting to play out in any kind of way in New Jersey on the ground?
They sure are, and it's a great way for you to close this because it sort of talks about the first part of our conversation, me being, you know, less significant to real people. New Jerseyans are really concerned about the cost of electricity. It has been going up and up, and that's, you know, besides taxes, because look, 14 campaigns for governor, I've been lied to 13 times by candidates of both parties who say they're going to cut taxes. They never do. But this electricity crisis is very real. And look, you guys know this better than I do. Chitterelli is not putting money behind the Navy cheating scandal. He's putting money behind cutting electricity costs and reducing the burden of government on the taxpayers. Those are the issues that are polling well. The other stuff, you know, plays great in these bubbles that we have on the internet, but the reality is that's what voters care about. And you just hit it on you hit the nail on the head. People are getting electricity bills, and it's not, you know, it's just one more thing that is unaffordable. Cheryl has pledged to freeze electricity costs. She's leading with that issue too. She's sort of running as a you know, if you close your eyes, you know, and just listen to the words, she sounds like a moderate Republican. And he's trying to sound like a moderate Republican. And that's where Jersey really is.
Hey, Mikey, if he's running as a moderate Republican, ask him what he thinks of J.D. Vance.
Okay.
Cool. Don't make the central thing, but put the glove. I want to thank you, David. I want to thank Susan McGee for recommending. This was a robust and sometimes contentious and agreeable session, and that's what we're all about here at Politics 2020 War Room. We don't mind body slamming every night.
David, you have made good as an analyst.
Thank you.
Newsletter is must reading for anybody interested in New Jersey politics. My only parting shot, not shot, is trust the Naval Academy, as I think you do. Thank you so much, David.
Thank you, man. You were great.
Thank you for having me.
You made me look good. Thank you, guy. All right.
James, our guest is the renowned Larry Sabato, politics professor at the University of Virginia, creator of Sabato's Crystal Ball, the great analysis of American politics. Larry, let's talk about your home state of Virginia. It'd be a shock if Abigail Spanberger isn't elected governor next month. Would a big victory say more about her, or would it say more about the weakness of the Republicans and their candidate?
Well, as always, it's both.
Usually.
Well, mostly it is. Yeah. I shouldn't overgeneralize. That's James's job, is overgeneralize. I'm kidding. We recently had him at UVA. It was fantastic.
Of course.
I would say this. The Republicans do not have an especially strong candidate. That's obvious to anyone who's followed this campaign. She's actually, in person, she's a very pleasant individual. But as a candidate, She has left a lot to be desired, and the Republicans will tell you that. You know, she hasn't campaigned all that hard, or at least she hasn't campaigned visibly. She hasn't been around like Spanberger has. And right. Spanberger is a very good candidate. She's disciplined, as so many candidates cannot be. She is very, very disciplined.
She comes across, too, Larry, as a moderate in the Tim Kaine, Mark Warner mold. Is that the way you think she'd govern?
Well, that's going to be interesting. Yes, she stresses the fact that she's been measured as the most bipartisan member of Congress, certainly from Virginia, and I think one of the most bipartisan in the country. But, you know, this is not the age of bipartisanship. Yeah. So I think her party base will push her to be more partisan. Now, whether she'll do it or not, I can't tell you. She doesn't like unnecessary fights. I don't think she likes fights at all. But it's going to be a difficult 4 years because three of them are going to be with Donald Trump.
Yeah. You know, look, the candidates for lieutenant governor and attorney general really on both sides are pretty weak. But we assumed until a couple weeks ago that with Spanberger, there was a sweep was likely. Then revelations that the Democratic attorney general candidate Jay Jones had sent out 3 years ago a stupid and deeply troubling email about firing bullets at an opponent. Republicans see this as a huge opportunity for picking off one of those seats and ending any notion of a sweep. It's too late to get him off the ticket. If Spanberger wins by 8, 10, or 11, is that enough to carry in Jones?
Probably. Probably, if it's that big a victory. You have to consider, though, it's also possible, and I've heard this from a number of Democrats, that this is shaving a point or two or three off of Spanberger. And you say, well, why is that? Because you're not going to have a large number of voters switching from the Democrat to the Republican for governor. But here's why. It has stirred up Republicans. They were not enthusiastic about Winsome Earle Sears and their ticket. And now they are. They're going to come out and vote because they're angry at the text that they read from Jay Jones, and they're angry at his reckless driving conviction, 116 miles an hour on Interstate 64. Though I think James has done that. I believe he has been that.
I've been a lot of time on I-64.
You know, that's a really, really good point. Let me just turn around. It may be the only good news for Jones, because, you know, what he did was just, you know, horrible. But Donald Trump called for removing him from the ticket. Trump said he was shocked at that inflammatory rhetoric. It's a little bit like Casablanca, you know, Captain Renault being shocked at this gambling upstairs. But could Trump actually be a bit of a salvation for Jones?
Well, look, the best issue Democrats have, if you call it an issue, is Donald Trump. And, right. Of course, he's an octopus. He's got arms leading to all kinds of issues that turn voters on or off. And he's obnoxious, and he's in the news 25 times a day in 24 hours. So, yeah, if there's any reason why Democrats would get even more pumped up than they have been, it would be Donald Trump. And you just know he's going to say a number of controversial slash stupid things between now and November 4th.
Right. James.
So, Professor, I'm going to ask you a question. Do you know why the UVA faculty runs out on the lawn during a thunderstorm?
I missed what you said.
I said, do you know why the faculty at UVA runs out on the lawn in the middle of a thunderstorm?
I don't, but why?
They think God's taking their picture. I'm not saying y'all.
Okay, that's good. That's, although I got to tell you, the faculty, staff, and students are going to be running out on the lawn noon on Friday, a big demonstration at the Rotunda to protest Trump's ridiculous education compact, which is nothing more than extortion.
It sure is.
Well, if they have a thunderstorm, you'll get more. Yeah. Like crazy turnout.
I'll pray for rain.
Larry, kudos to the MIT and Dartmouth presidents for saying that compact.
Absolutely. Notice not a word from
Let's hope UVA follows. Right.
Yeah. I will start this conversation by saying that Larry and I go back to 1982, and I did a thing with a testimony to him and told a story about the asshole from Charlottesville. But then I also said something that I genuinely mean. Larry has been the most influential political academic of my lifetime, period. End of discussion.
I'll bet you say that to all the professors.
You know what? I don't, actually, but that's okay. I tell all the girls that. So I'm familiar with Virginia. I work there. I follow it. I have a place there. I spent a lot of time in Virginia. And if you want to get you everywhere, and we all know the South Side, Metro Richmond, Hampton Roads, Shenandoah Valley, Northern Virginia, et cetera, et cetera. If I had to pick one place that I think Spanberger is going to overperform, I think it's going to be Hampton Roads. And I'll give you my logic. Because for the first time in 50 years, a Democrat in a special election, a loss, a House seat in Florida won, carried Escambia County. Escambia County and Hampton Roads have a lot in common. They're the biggest naval bases in the United States. I bet you 3/4 of the United States Navy domestically is between Pensacola and Norfolk or something like that, if you will. And I think where Spanberger, given her background and given all of the stuff is doing, I think that she's going to, by more than a little bit, overperform with the kind of military community vote, the naval community vote. That's just a theory of mine. Though she's going to run like crazy with the federal employees in Fairfax and Loudoun and Alexandria City. All right. And I also, as you know, I have a place in Shenandoah Valley. I spent a lot of time in there. Shenandoah County is probably 74% Republican performing county. It's going to be interesting to see how many vote. And does the AG candidate, you make a good point, how much of an effect that's going to have? Because prior to this, I don't think, I count in, and I don't believe in George Sides, okay? I think they indicate something. And there were 18 Trump signs on my way from my farm into downtown Woodstock. Today, there's one Earl Sears sign. I think it means something. I don't know, but that's what I'm going to be watching for. What are you going to be watching for early on election night? What's going to be, what do you think the whole card's going to be?
Well, of course, Northern Virginia comes in later because they have such an enormous mail vote. They're supposed to report right away, and we'll see whether they have improved because of the reforms there. But I'm looking more at the Richmond area, the suburbs of Richmond, which you remember,
James. Chesterfield and RICO. Yeah,
Chesterfield and Hanover and RICO, which is now heavily Democratic. And they used to kill almost all Democratic candidates. You remember that.
Ooh, George Stoddard and I thought about jackknifing an 18-wheeler on the bridge from Richmond to Chesterfield to stop the traffic so they couldn't vote. We actually were trying to divide. Thank God we never did, so it's okay.
But as a thought, that's not a bad idea because it might have worked, you know, if you'd lowered the vote there. But it's totally changed. I mean, it really has. Even Chesterfield, which is a conservative place, and where Glenn Youngkin, 4 years ago, won handily. Democrats have generally been winning. Kamala Harris won Chesterfield. Can you believe that?
No, I can't.
And she won. She won by the same percentage Hillary won by in 2016 statewide. So, look, Virginia has tilted much more Democratic for sure. And I think it may be a little more than that. I would have predicted a very sizable margin for Spanberger if it hadn't been for Jay Jones. And the headlines here, every day, Jones. This guy is monumentally stupid. And candidates, unfortunately, believe they can always hide their dark pasts. And half the time they do, but half the time they don't, and it kills their party.
Yeah, I supposedly he didn't tell her. That's the street rumor, and she's living.
Who is that?
Jones didn't tell Spanberger.
Oh, Spanberger.
And he knew this was in his background.
Yeah,
and
well.
That's what I hear on the street.
I honestly don't know about that, but I can tell you that many of the Spanberger people supported the other candidate who got 49%, Shannon Taylor, who's a prosecutor, and she would have been perfect for that slot. So, you know, sometimes primary voters goof, but on the other hand, they didn't know about all this. None of it was released. Why don't parties do oppo research on their own candidates anymore?
Well, this is one consultant that did a lot of oppo research. Let me tell you.
I know you did.
On our own candidate. I got 5 books on Bill Clinton.
I know.
All right. Go ahead, Al. So, by the way, Larry, we're going to Berkeley with our friend at UMass, Alexander. He's very excited because I did UVA in Berkeley with the documentary.
He is very excited. He is, and he was here for many, many years as my associate director, and I hope to bring him back. But we'll see what happens.
Let me try a question, Larry. You mentioned Glenn Youngkin a few moments ago. 3.5 years ago, he was the Republicans' golden boy. He might even be the nominee. He was going to be kind of a respectable Donald Trump, kind of sounds like an oxymoron. It seems to me he's leaving office an abject failure. He failed to get his most important priority through the sports and entertainment complex, which he said was the most important project in the history of Virginia. Democrats say he never even talked to people about it. He couldn't. He's lost seats in the legislature. He couldn't even knock off the Republican lieutenant gubernatorial candidate. And it looks like he's leaving with no place to go. The golden boy really, really has failed. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I think he has certainly amounted to a whole lot less than Republicans expected him to be.
Right.
I can't tell you how many people came up to me after he was elected and said, he's going to be the next nominee. He will be president.
Right.
And the ones who said, no, I don't think he'll be the nominee for president said, well, you know, he's going to be the VP nominee at least. Well, none of that happened. Now, he still has presidential ambitions. Maybe he's thinking about 2028, but how does he break in to Vance and Rubio? I mean, I just don't see it. Also, he made a strategic error, in my view, that is going to hurt him long term. Yes, I know the Republicans are semi-permanently MAGA, but he became someone who kept Trump at arm's length in 2021, 2022. And suddenly he became, in 2024, Trump's poodle. Now, Trump's got a lot of poodles, but it just didn't fit. And he didn't really believe, I think, in a lot of things that Trump has done. And second, Virginia is strongly anti-Trump. And he certainly wasn't representing this state in being so pro-Trump.
Larry, let me ask you a final question from me, and that is your reach, your expertise goes beyond the state of Virginia. You have followed all of this gerrymandering stuff. Texas did theirs. California will almost certainly offset that. But there's a number of other states, Missouri and Indiana, Ohio, and now North Carolina. How do you think this all is going to end up as far as 2026 is concerned?
Well, my guess right now is that since Republicans are moving so hard on it, thanks to the Trump White House putting pressure on them, Republicans are going to gain net probably 5 to 7 seats, and it could be a little more than that. That is considering the 5 seats Democrats are taking in California. That is, their net gain is 5 to 7 after they lose maybe 4 or 5 of those seats in California. But here's the worst part, Al. This is really disturbing. You see the court arguing today about the Louisiana case. They're really listening to arguments about Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, and they have given every indication that they're likely to minimize it or even explode it. Now, what does that mean? It means that the heavily Republican southern states, for example, heavy Republican legislators, the Republican governors, will literally dismember black district after black district after black district. And some have calculated that Democrats would have to win a landslide in the popular vote nationally to ever win the House again, because they're going to lose 5 to 7 through gerrymandering or more. And they're going to lose, is it 8? Is it 10? Is it 12 seats? Thanks to the Supreme Court decision, if it happens, on Section 2. Think about that. Yeah, Democrats picked up 40 seats in 2018, but that was under another census and under different lines.
Right.
Things are not going the Democrats' way, and they have got to wake up fast. There's nothing they can do about the Supreme Court. They lost that battle years ago, but it's having a major impact, and it will make our system extremely uncompetitive, extremely uncompetitive. And that ought to disturb everybody. Do we want a Duma? Is that what we want?
James, you want to wrap this up?
So, Professor Savitar, if we go back a long time and we did come different backgrounds, different things, but we're in the same profession, politics. Tell, in your retirement, toward the both of us at the end of our careers. What is it about politics that attracted you? And if you look back on your career, are you glad that you chose politics as your academic discipline?
That's a great question. And look, James, you're much older than I am. I'm just 73.
Oh, you're a young guy, man.
Don't end my career. But actually, you're right. I mean, I'm moving toward the end for sure. Look, when I was first turned on by John F. Kennedy coming to Norfolk on the Friday before the Tuesday election, and that excited me like I'd never been excited before. I was 7 or 8 at the time. And I was hooked. And that's what I always tell parents. Make sure you take your kids to the polls. Take your kids to a rally. Get them excited about politics. I went to it because I really, even though I grew up in the 50s, I was still young in the 60s, in elementary and high school in the 60s. And that was the place to make change. And our country needed changes. And, you know, when you're young, you're anti-establishment almost by inclination. And I was so excited about participating in the changes. And it was an awful decade, but it was a hopeful decade, okay? And that became even more true as we went along. And I was just hooked from the beginning. That's why I went into it, to make change, to see the country progress, to see the world progress. And I think mainly it has, at least until recently. And am I happy I went into it? Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm not saying I made any difference, but I participated and I tried to teach young people to get active. And many of them have, and they're in office and they're working on campaigns. And I'm thrilled about that. So,
well, Larry, I will just say you have made a lot of people happy that you've gone into politics. And this is another one of John F. Kennedy's contributions to get you in. You have been a terrific guest, and we thank you so much for being with us.
I've enjoyed it as always, and thank both of you, and I love both of you, and keep it up, and just keep going.
I share your thing that politics is driven by great people more than great issues of the day. It's people. Democrats have not had an inspiring candidate since 2012. We've got to change that in 2028.
And Larry right. James lives in Virginia. I was born in Charlottesville, so we got Virginia connections.
Excellent. That's why you're good people. That's right there.
All right. Stay off the lawn during the thunderstorm, man.
The Education Department, James, over the past week gutted the Office of Special Education. This is the office responsible for the treatment and rights of 7.5 children, school children, children with disabilities. This is indecent. Linda McMahon, the Secretary of Education, co-owned a company, the World Wrestling Entertainment, with her ex-husband, Vince, a true deplorable. They delighted in making fun of people with disabilities. Eugene, the mentally challenged fan, or the wrestler with Bell's palsy. Secretary McMahon may have wisely left the creepy Vince, but she was part of those sickening episodes. Budget Director Russell Vogt, who oversees all these cuts, has a daughter with cystic fibrosis. The Office of Special Education's mission is to look out for people with conditions like cystic fibrosis. To gut the Office of Special Education is bad policy perpetrated by bad people.
Well, a little bit further. Didn't Leonard Leo have a daughter that had some profound challenges?
She was born with spina bifida, but he wasn't involved in this one.
I don't care for it, but the whole operation, I mean, I'm saying he was involved. I'm just making a point. I have that in my family. I should have been in special ed. I'm profound but dyslexic. I have learning disabilities. I had a daughter. She has not made a B since junior in high school and undergrad and graduate school. She availed herself to... She was a special learner when she was in the third grade. Let's just put it like that. I don't mind saying that. And let me tell you something. There's enormous talent among these people all over the country. And what they do when they get the kind of education that they need, they can turn and they can flourish and they can be really productive citizens. We should not somehow or another be some kind of country that you give somebody a test when they're 8 years old and you determine what their future is. So I'm particularly appalled at this. because I've seen it work, and I've seen it work well in my own family. I had a brother who had this. It runs in my family, and it runs in a lot of families. Yeah. And it's inhumane, it's stupid, it's asinine, and it doesn't even save that much money. It's cruel.
No,
so
it is.
It's a good special ed.
Absolutely.
All right?
Okay.
The thing about what they do much better than us, if we have a stupid candidate, they make us pay for it. They have a stupid candidate, and we pivot to another thing, or we think that that is. Piers Morgan, okay, say what you want about Piers Morgan. A candidate for governor of California named Betty Yee, Y-E-E, went on Piers Morgan show and said, and I'm quoting, this is what he put out, could be bullshit, but it's probably true. I think transgender female athletes and women athletes, and they should be able to compete. California governor runner Betty Yee says she would like to see a gender-neutral Olympics take place in Los Angeles. What bullshit? Okay, and I want to take this Betty Yee from the standpoint of somebody that has daughters and somebody that my daughters were never particularly athletic, but I have a lot of friends that have daughters that play soccer, play volleyball, run track, play softball. You know what their parents don't want them doing for good fucking reason is competing with males. So let's do this little experiment. Let's take the last Olympics. Let's take the 2020 last Olympics we had and take the winning female time or distance or whatever you can measure objectively and see where they would have finished if they were competing against males. Because what you're doing, you understand what you're doing to try to some kind of cheap political point with a bunch of left-wing zombies is you're ruining the women that work their asses off, that compete. And by the way, there's been an explosion in interest in women's sports. And I give a good amount of credit to Coach Kim Mulkey, my dear friend, who's LSU women's basketball coach.
And to Richard
Nixon.
The
last thing they need to do is be competing against the Duke men's basketball team. This is asinine, asinine, asinine.
It's actually an insult to Title IX, which you have to give Richard Nixon credit
for. Right.
It's
just like, what? Where do these people come from? What
everything.
Rock do they crawl from under?
And now for the questions from our incredibly smart listeners. The first one is from Bill in Houston, who, James, asked you, the Supreme Court seems to always rule in Trump's favor. Why is that? Tough
one. Yeah, it's actually a very easy answer. The United States Supreme Court, and I say this, and a lot of people are going to resist thinking that because it's a terrible thing. They're an adjunct of the Republican Party. They're not a court that, you know, normally what happens is, the way that you're taught is, you have two different sets of facts. It goes before a judge. They kind of study the law. They may have a little different interpretation. Somebody, statutory interpretation, a legislative intent, stare decisis, and this goes into it. That's not the way this court operates. And I want to front and center John Roberts, because he is the villain here. Okay, no one wants to like deal with the fact that the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court is a partisan political hack. I'm sorry, he is. So when they get a case, they don't like tell the clerk, let's look at this, I want to see that. I think they say, what is the result that is most beneficial to the Republican Party? Then that's the result we're going to arrive at. Brett Kavanaugh, all right, was Ken Starr's top guy who sat there and leaked grand jury. It was well known, all right? It was leaking like crazy, particularly to a journalist named Sue Schmidt, all right? I don't have to tell you what Gorsuch or Clarence Thomas, all right, where he gets his money from. I have to tell you that John Roberts' wife made $10 million placing people in law firms that practice law before a husband's court. Get over it, America. Your court is not a legal court. It is a partisan adjunct of the Republican Party, and your chief justice is nothing but a Republican Party political hack.
And
that's the truth.
If they rule to gut the Voting Rights Act totally to help elect maybe a dozen or more Republicans, they need to register as a Republican PAC.
Absolutely.
Chris in Ellicott City, Maryland asked, do you think the No Labels movement can help us achieve greater unity in Washington? Absolutely no. I think it's basically a scam, Mark. It's been run by Mark Penn and others, and I think they've raised money. They won't reveal where they get their money from. And I must say, I have very little respect for No Labels. I think they really kind of, you know.
There's another group called Third Way that people think a little bit more of. And I don't have a problem with you know, some kind of return to kind of, but not Third Way. Third Way is a scam. They don't report where their money comes from. As always with these things, how much is the cut? You know, for every dollar that goes into No Labels, where does it go? How is it allocated?
You know, next, Ken in Denver, Colorado said, what's going to happen if Trump invokes the Insurrection Act, James?
Well, we're going to find out. That's my theory. If this thing in Virginia goes the way I think it's going to go, and it goes in New Jersey the way I hope it goes, and they continue to keep losing this budgetary battle that they're in the middle of now, and it's apparent that they're going to lose and lose badly in 2026 as a possibility, he's going to try. And I'm telling every person that comes up to me, and I have to tell you, it is frequent. It's multi times every day that says they're really scared. And my answer is, you have every right to be scared.
Yep.
I can't tell you how it's coming, but it's coming. Okay? It's coming. They are going to try to do anything they can to interfere with this election. The Supreme Court, the adjunct of the Republican Party, understand what's happening in Louisiana. Louisiana is a state that is one-third black, and they are going to draw a map, and we're not going to have a black congressman. And John Roberts and the pack of hacks are going to say that's fine.
Yep.
There is a right to vote that's guaranteed to you in the Fifth Amendment. You have the right to vote. You just don't have the right to have your vote counted. What a fucking fiasco.
Right. No, it's absolutely a fiasco. Jason in Washington, D.C., inside the Beltway, says transgender issues like bathrooms and sports continue to pull Democrats down. How do we best message this issue in the future? Jason, you don't. You stay away from it. You say it's unfair to try to hurt transgender kids, but I'm sorry, transgender women should not be playing in men's sports. Now, that's just not two old guys talking. We had Martina Navratilova on this show, one of the greatest tennis players of all times, a real champion of civil and human rights, and she said that. So don't get caught up in that stuff. There are other issues you ought to be talking about.
So does Seth Moulton. So does Gavin Newsom. So does Ruben Gallego. I don't know what you're talking about, man. Okay? And let my hero in all of this is Spencer Cox, the Republican governor of Utah, that passes trans and sports bill in the Utah legislation. He said, look, there's 100,000 athletes and high school athletes in Utah and six are transgender. That's somebody else's problem.
Yeah, no, absolutely okay. Right.
That's it.
James, I'm going to follow up on that previous question to you. John in Chicago says, if Democrats get back in charge of the government, should they get rid of the Insurrection Act?
No. I mean, that's probably, it was like 1809 or something like that. But given the fractures we have and given the how aggressive that these racists have become, it's a threat to the United States. I don't know enough about it, but I would think long and hard before I got rid of it because it's just a fucking possibility.
Yeah,
there are people out there who want to start a goddamn civil war.
Clearly, that's what they want to do. Maybe you can figure out a way to tailor the Insurrection Act. That's difficult.
Yeah, okay.
But it serves a purpose. There are times there are insurrections. There was a civil war.
There was one.
You can't conform.
There was a January the 6th. Yes, Soto. There was a January the 6th. And this, and they say Biden put 254 FBI agents. He wasn't even president.
He wasn't president.
Right.
Come on. How did Joe Biden, an ex-president, how did he order the FBI into action?
Right. It is a real threat. Democrats should, we should tread very lightly on the Insurrection Act because they would start an insurrection in a minute.
Right. Jeff in Asheville, North Carolina. This is a really good and a very disturbing development. Dominion Voting Systems was recently acquired by a company called Liberty Vote, which is run by a former Republican operative and election official. They defended, and they won a huge suit, I believe, against Fox News. They defended the integrity of their voting system. Then they sold it to a Republican operative. I have been very sympathetic, supportive of Dominion Voting Systems. I just think this was a cowardly thing to do, a greedy thing to do. Surely they could have found another buyer. And it's really disturbing, James.
It's beyond disturbing. And you have this accumulation of wealth where you have Larry Ellison. They're buying up every news thing. They're buying up everything. All right, now I have a right to buy and sell what you want. This is the United States. But now they're taking over the voting machines. They're taking over, and they're very aggressive in buying up all of these different press entities. You know, you have Bezos now owns the Washington Post. I'm going to give Washington Post a little bit of a shout out here. They're still doing some pretty good goddamn stories.
They really are.
Okay? They need some credit for that. But is it disturbing that they're going to own the processes of which a lot of people vote? Is it disturbing that they're going to own the information, you know, some big information distribution points? Yeah, it's real disturbing.
Yeah.
And it gives you all the more reason when you have these fucking idiots telling Democrats you don't have a stake in this. You know, it's all the same thing. It's the National League or the American League and all this bullshit you hear. Don't buy it. You should be afraid. You should be very afraid. Do not trust the Supreme Court. You got to follow what they say. I'm not suggesting that you be lawless here, but what I'm saying is, they don't give a shit about the law, and these people are buying it up because they want to have a right wing. And Russell Voigt and all of these fucking people in there, and these Christian nationalists, they have power and they want this country. And they are going. And there's a chance that if we keep listening to the American League, National League assholes in the national media, they'll get it.
Final question comes from Tom in Kennewick, Washington. Should Democrats start using that old phrase, trickle-down economics, more fervently in their messaging? That has worked in the past. Would it work now?
The short answer is yes. And the other answer is it's true.
Totally true.
We cut, $3 trillion from taxes? For people making over about $400,000 a year, we're cutting veterans, we're cutting healthcare like crazy. For the first time, I just got a text, and I think it's reliable, that says the interest on the debt now exceeds national defense. So if you love America, yes, trickle down doesn't work on any level. It's so many times it's been disproved. And do this at home. Look at economic performance, Democratic presence versus Republican presence. Your eyes are going to pop out at the difference. So
right.
Yes, you're damn right.
Listen, we love those questions. Please, if we didn't get to yours this week, please send them in again. We'll try to get to it next week because this is probably one of our favorite segments. We love all of our segments, but this one is particularly good. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Now, following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the link to our sponsor, ZBiotics, and our episode show notes. We deeply thank you for supporting them because when you do, you help make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go and take a look. You can also find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room Planning.